Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Lynn Jackson, who is half of the Lynn Jackson and Michael Poulter duo. If you were listening last week, you heard my interview with Michael, and in it, of course, he talked about Lynn. So this is Lynn's version of some of the things that Michael said, and also her story, which is compelling, unique, and inspiring. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap with all the time. Says all on tap. Oh, I really can. Oh, I really can. Turn down all the noise so
The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. It's about being all the things that your particular person is capable of being, the things you came in with that are natural to you. As a therapist, I am continually confronted by people who, it seems to me, are not being who they really are. They are being somebody else told them they had to be, or somebody that they read in a magazine they had to be, or saw on TV they had to be, or that the people that they hang with, their peer group, are, have to be, say they have to be, or more punitively, they are not some of the things they really are because they were told that quality about them, that skill that they seem to have, that way of being in the world was not acceptable. It was ugly. It was awkward. It was embarrassing. It was funny. If you were a girl, it was not how girls are. If you were a boy, it is not how boys are. These messages, which come too frequently from our family of origin, and way too frequently from the rest of our society. As I say in almost every show, you can get these messages from your peer group, you can get them from teachers, you can get them from your culture, from your religion, from everywhere. There are messages telling us who we should be and who we shouldn't be. And so it becomes difficult to simply be the person you are without second guessing, without wondering, without asking yourself, without guilt or shame. This is who I am. This is how I stand. This is how I talk. This is how I laugh. This is the kinds of things I like to do in my life. These are the things that interest me. I like to read. I don't like to read. I like to dance. I don't like to dance. Whatever it is. Because as a therapist, it's so clear to me that when you are at odds with who you really are, even if you manage to pull off the image that other people have said to you or that you have decided is the right way, you don't feel good. It's that thing about being a phony, and if people really knew me, they wouldn't like me. And in addition to that, it takes energy to suppress who you really are, and that energy is stolen from the things you could be doing in your life. So it is clear to me that not being at odds with yourself, being fully accepting of who you are and demonstrating that person in the world is what makes for comfort, serenity, tranquility, happiness, energy, what other people might call mental health. And so that's what the Lynn Show is about. It's about making this point, saying, you know, if you think that that's not true of you, if you think that you're in denial or hiding or had to suppress something about yourself, it's not too late to find it and access it and use it and enjoy it. If you want to hear more about that, you want to talk to me about that, you can find me on my website. That is thelynshow.com, thelynneshow, thelynshow.com. Up there you can click on email me and ask me any questions that you might have. I'd love to hear from you. You can get me to come and talk about this at your group or organization. You can find my book. You can find my CD. And you can listen to all of the shows, including the one I'm doing right now. And you can go back through the some 300 shows that I've done and listen to all the interviews that I've done, including the one I'm going to air in a minute or two. And all of those interviews are with people who make their living or their life with an art. And I interview these people because when you listen to them, inevitably you hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. We make it so difficult for people to give a life, to make a living as an artist in this culture, that the people who do it because it is who they are. And it is my hope that when you listen, you are inspired. You say to yourself, am I doing that? Do I feel that way about the work in my life, the way I live my life, the interactions that I have in my life? And if the answer is no, that you begin to think about recovering whatever it is you might have had to sacrifice. I like to caution that it's not so simple as, oh my gosh, I realize I left something behind, let me go and get it. Because when you go and get it, the reasons that you left it behind also return. And so it can be difficult, but it is definitely possible. And I encourage all of you, if you think there's something you left behind, to consider pursuing it. So today's interview with Lynn Jackson is a demonstration of what it means to be who you really are. Lynn's story, which is a story of someone who continually found herself in places that didn't fit and had to keep looking for the place that did fit and has found it and is gloriously in it. And you hear it, you hear all of it. The struggle, the challenge, the courage. It's really quite wonderful. As I said in the run-up, Lynn Jackson is married to and partner to Michael Poulter, who I interviewed last week. Because Michael's interview was so long, and I really didn't want to cut any of it, I didn't get to play a cut of Michael singing. I did get to play their glorious song, We Dream a Brighter Day, But I didn't get to play a cut of Michael singing. So now I'm going to play a cut from Lynn Jackson and Michael Poulter's current album called Sitting on a Rainbow. And this cut combines two songs. Michael singing You Are There and Lynn singing Sweet Bitter Love. And that's going to lead right into my interview with Lynn. So here now is Michael Poulter, followed by Lynn Jackson singing, and then Lynn Jackson telling us her story.
In the evening, when the kettle's on for tea, an old familiar feeling settles over me, and it's your face I see. And I believe that you are there, in a garden, when I stop to touch a rose and feel its petals soft and sweet against my nose, I smile, and I suppose that somehow maybe you are there. When I'm dreaming and I find myself awake without a warning, and I rub my eyes and fantasize, and all at once I realize it's morning, and my fantasy is fading like a distant star at dawn. My dearest dream is gone. I often think there's just one thing to do: pretend the dream is true and tell myself that you are there.
Sweet bitter love, the taste still lingers. Though through my helpless fingers you slipped away, sweet, sweet bitter love, what joy. What pain you taught me in so short a stay. My magic dreams have lost their spell. A trusting heart like mine. trusting heart like mine.
Okay, so I'm here with Lynn Jackson in the same place that I was with her husband, partner, other half, Michael Poulter, who you heard last week. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And the art to which you have clearly given your life is music.
Right.
Right. And I only ask one question, and it is,
yeah.
Do you remember the very first moment in your life when music called you?
Well, I remember that my grandma played piano, and I would listen to her.
How old were you?
Oh, I was probably maybe 7, 8, 9, 10.
Mm-hmm.
And she would play Charmaine.
Oh.
I remember she sang along, and my mom sang along, and my daddy sang along. And it was just part of growing up. And I later learned that she played the piano in the silent movie houses.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that's what she did.
Okay, so music was a sort of a part of your family life.
Yes, always. My parents would listen to, on Sundays, they would always have the symphony on,
mm-hmm.
or operas and stuff. And they would be reading the newspaper and stuff. So it would always be flowing around. Or there would be Broadway music or Pete Seeger or, you know, there was always something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so, you play. So did you one day say, gee, I think I'd like to do what Grandma does? Or did you plunk around at the piano? Or did somebody say to you, you should have piano lessons? Do you remember?
I don't remember, but I know I took them.
Right. Oh, so you took them. Do you remember if you liked them or you didn't like them or you felt good about it or you hated it? Or?
I don't remember that I didn't like it. I mean, I think I started before I was a teenager. I
mm-hmm.
did. And then I stopped taking piano lessons when I moved from East Meadow, Long Island to Swampscott, Massachusetts. And I started taking voice lessons when I was a teenager.
Oh.
Because I already could play the piano by ear, kind of, you know. So I didn't want to be a concert pianist, and I liked to sing. So I...
You could play piano by ear?
Yeah.
And you knew that because you sat down and played stuff you heard?
Yeah. I just played by ear.
It just came easy, yeah. Right?
It came easy, yeah.
Okay, so you liked to sing, so you...
I sang and played, yeah.
So did you ask for voice lessons? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. Okay, good. So, but you do remember taking them?
I do remember taking them, and they were, it was funny, there were a couple who made their living at nightclubs. She was a drummer. She wore these, like, almost like these Gone with the Wind costumes. Like, I picture her in tutus. And she was this, like, older lady, you know, with gray hair and glasses and stuff. And her husband was blind. And he played the piano.
Good grief!
And his whole reason for living was his train set in the basement, which he was constantly doing when they weren't doing lessons or playing gigs.
No. A kind of braille thing with the train set?
I have no idea how he did it, you know, but it was like a big, humongous, beautiful train set. It took a whole room.
Good,
you know.
God. So she played drums, he played piano,
yeah.
He played trains,
yeah.
But they taught voice? Did
yeah.
either one of them sing?
You know, I'm not so sure. They did teach me, and they taught voice.
Mm-hmm.
Afterwards, I realized that maybe they weren't voice teachers,
yes,
maybe
right.
coaches.
Right.
They would... you know, go over songs with me, like the American Great American Songbook, like, you know, My Funny Valentine and Right as the Rain, and I guess they started a repertoire,
mm-hmm.
you know. They were gig musicians.
Yeah, 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 yeah,
that's
yeah.
what I realize now, but they were a great help because they pushed me into that world nicely, you know.
Yeah, did they choose the songs, do you remember, or do you remember that there was a song you wanted to learn?
Probably some of both.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he would plunk it down, and I would take a cassette recorder home and sing to it.
Wow.
You know.
Wow. So you were building a repertoire, really.
I guess so.
Right, and you had a natural voice.
Yeah.
So they weren't so much teaching you how to sing. All right, so this is before you're a teenager, or you're in the teenagers?
I'm in the teenagers.
So do you want to be a singer? Do you care? Is there anything else you want to do?
I always wanted to do music. I don't know whether I wanted to be a singer. I did go to classical music school, and I would spend hours and hours and hours, hours, outside of other people's practice rooms, listening to incredible playing. You know, but I just wasn't a practicer. I just
right.
wasn't disciplined.
You went to classical music school. Are you saying...
I went to Longy School of Music in Cambridge, but only for a year and a half.
Well, was that academic as well, or that was separate from your regular school? Do you know what I mean?
I graduated high school.
Right.
I went to Israel. That's what I did.
Okay.
To get away.
Wow.
And then I came back and went to Longy School of Music.
That was your choice. Now you're an adult, really, and you can
yeah.
choose what you want to do.
Right.
And so you think to yourself, I want to be in music, so I'm going to go there.
Right.
So you go there, and most of the time you're just listening to other people play?
I mean, I studied well,
yeah?
And I did very well, but I didn't practice.
Yeah.
And then soon after Longy, I got into drugs. I left Longy and became a hippie and lived on the Boston Commons for a while.
Wow. So hold on for a second, because I'm really curious. When you say I did really well, what I hear you saying is it was natural to me and it was fairly easy to me. I didn't practice, but I had a facility. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And all of this really comes from before, when you could play what you heard.
When I could fudge.
Yeah.
I'm a good fudger.
Right.
Yeah.
But
I actually couldn't fudge Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart.
Okay.
Because those teachers knew how they went.
Yeah.
You can fudge jazz.
Yes, that's
you can
right.
fudge
right.
folk singing
right.
and playing. But
right.
So I did well in my courses and stuff.
Right.
But when it came to actually memorizing and playing a sonata,
right.
you know, I don't think that, you know, that didn't work.
No.
Guess it.
But you listened to everybody else.
Oh, yeah. I loved it.
Wow.
But, you know, my parents were paying for this.
Right.
You know, and it wasn't for me. What I ended up going, well, eventually going to Berkeley.
Oh, okay. Let's go back. So you leave Longy,
mm-hmm.
and essentially you drop out.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. And
a hiatus.
Yes, a hiatus, right.
Yes.
You take the Boston Common hiatus,
that's right.
right?
Yes.
Right.
That was when they were burning their draft cards.
Right.
Right in front of the Arlington Street Church is where they burn their draft cards, and I was there for a while.
What year is this?
I actually slept in the Arlington Street Church. Could have been 68, 69,
yeah, right.
something like that.
When all of that was happening.
When it was happening.
Right, yeah. Okay. And do you remember what made you leave there or stop that? Or
yes, I totally remember. I was on LSD, and I was singing in the Arlington Street Church. They had a piano, and all these people were around. I remember, oh my God, people get ready, there's a train coming, and I just remember singing that and everyone starting to sing along with me, and it was just a miraculous, miraculous morning. I think it was like 3 a.m, and the person who was there, who was working for the church to see that everything was okay,
mm-hmm.
Actually became a friend, and then I eventually lived with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not on drugs, and he was a music critic for the Boston Phoenix. And so I ended up being with him, and he was also a pianist at the same time. which that didn't work out too well. But then I began to go to Berkeley, and that's
so. So this is the transition. This guy transitions you out of. He heard you do this, and he came and got you essentially.
Yeah,
right,
right.
Right. He said you're special. Right, right.
Yeah.
And so he's your bridge essentially.
He's my bridge.
Right, and you get straight, I assume, with him.
Yes.
More or less.
Yes.
Right. Yes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And so then now you're out of the hippie world essentially.
Right.
And you've had some exposure to, I mean, he's a music critic, so you have had some exposure
opera
to the
opera and he was wonderful.
Yeah. Right. So now in a way this is a reflection of what your early life and your family was like.
Yeah.
Right? Right.
You're good.
Okay, good. Okay, fine. And so then you must have recognized in yourself a yearning to do this or have more of it or something.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So which is when I went started
right,
going to
go to Berkeley. Berkeley. Right.
Yeah.
And in Berkeley you study piano,
studied piano theory, arranging. And I was there for only a year and a half as well, because then I met Michael.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, so you went back and lived at home?
I actually lived with a friend whom I met on the Boston Common when she was a hippie. Mm-hmm. And she had decided to go to art school.
Oh.
And so we roomed together.
A very fertile ground. The Boston Common.
Yes, very fertile ground.
Okay, so you're living with her, and then you meet Michael. Michael comes and... Now, he told us the story of your father's playing golf and making a shit out of Angelique. Is that how you remember it or not?
Well, yes. His wife left him.
Ah.
And my boyfriend, the one who was...
Right, right, the music critic.
Left me.
Wow.
And so we both respectively ended up in our parents' homes, which is why the father said, gee, got a girl, I got a boy, get them out of the house.
Yes, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great.
And that's what happened. And he just swept me off my feet. Ha, ha, ha. Did he tell you the story about how we went to California and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, he did, but I would like you to, if you don't mind.
Oh, well, it really...
As much of it as you remember.
I just remember that he was always kvetching about having to go to, you know, somewhere where we would be appreciated, you know.
So you were playing together?
We were playing together,
yeah.
And he told you about the check in his coat and stuff like that?
The check in his coat.
Oh, okay, so, all right, so we were friendly with this guy who went to Berkeley, and Michael was always kvetching about how he would really like to get out of this one-horse town, you know, Boston, and we were just having lunch with this guy, and he was a friend, and he said, stop kvetching, or he didn't say kvetching.
Yeah, right.
He said, here, look, I'm going to write you a check. Go to L.A. already.
Yeah.
And he wrote us a check for $500.
Yeah. He did tell me that, but he told me it was $7.
Oh. Well, it could have been, but I think it was $5.
So then you go to L.A.
Right.
And okay, so I'm curious, what is your memory of how, when you arrive in L.A., what happens?
The big word was self-contained group. You had to be a self-contained group.
What does that mean?
It means that if you have two people, you both have to play and sing.
Really?
If you want to be a duo,
right.
They would rather hire a duo than a trio.
I see. Right. So
we were a self-contained group. But we weren't when we first went. When we first came to L.A., we, you know, Alan Broadbent and some other people and another drummer played for us, and we just stood up front. But we didn't get many gigs because that was
an expensive...
What's that called? A quintet?
Yes, right. Well, but it's expensive because it's a lot of people, right?
Yeah.
Right. I didn't realize that Michael didn't always play the bass.
Oh, no. And we started out with him playing the piano.
Yeah, that's what he told me.
Until I realized that I could play in more keys than he could.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, because he can do very well in C, but he, you know, doesn't read music. To this day, he, you know, it's like a Samson with his hair cut off, you know. No, my ears are good. Anyhow, so I played the cocktail drums, you know, and he played the piano in C. And then, well, you know, the bass was left at our house, and he picked it up. And Michael actually has better ears than I do, because I have ears, but I have all the...
You have training.
Training that kind of gets in the way, actually.
Yes,
so
yes.
He's kind of right about the Samson and the hair.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so now, he didn't talk about it, and I don't know whether you want to. He said, you know, that the arrival of David is a miracle.
Well, yes.
I know.
You were there.
I was there, is exactly right. Do you mind telling the story? Because he didn't talk about it at all.
Oh, no, I don't mind. No. During my days as a hippie, I contracted gonorrhea.
Mm.
And acute peritonitis. And they had to take out my right ovary and my right tube and ovary.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, it'll be okay because I still have a left tube and ovary. But when we got to L.A. and I was having pains, and I went to a gynecologist, and he said, your left tube is totally occluded.
Your left tube was
occluded.
It was like blocked.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I had always wanted to have children.
Yeah.
You know? It was a big thing with me. And it was very, very depressing after that.
And you believed them, that you were occluded and couldn't have a child.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
It was in the pictures.
That's,
you know, they showed me.
Right.
You know.
Oh, yes. Right.
And then a few years later, I was back in Boston seeing the old gynecologist that I had gone to when I was a teenager, and who also performed the surgery when I had the right tube and ovary removed. And his name is Dr. Ingersoll, and Michael and I constantly say, oh, that's an Ingersoll, because he said to me, if you want to have a child, you'll have a child. I've seen women with their tubes tied having children, you know. And then I got pregnant. The first time I got pregnant, it was in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
But before we went to Houston, we had been working at this Beverly Hills Chinese restaurant, where there was no one in the lounge where we were working, but there were two people in the dining room, and they happened to have been like talent scouts.
Mm.
And they came up to us afterwards, and they said, you're really good, you know, I'll give you our card, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we said, thank you. And we said, we're going to Houston, and they said, well, that's good, you know, have a good gig.
Mm-hmm.
So while we were in Houston, while we were at the gynecologist's office in Houston, because I was having pain in Houston, the hotel that we were playing in Houston, Houston Oaks, called us and said that we had a call from the Dinah Shoe Show. And Michael
the said, Dinah Shoe Show?
And what is that? And he finally figured out, because it wasn't an English-speaking person who was calling. Oh my God, the Dinah Shore Show just called. And we're in this office, and I've just been told that I am having pain because I have a ectopic pregnancy.
Oy.
Okay? The Dinah Shore, he calls the Dinah Shore people back and say, they said, if you can be here in 3 days, we can have you in on our show. And so there was no question that we were going to do it, you know. Whatever happened, I can wait till afterwards.
Right.
So we went to L.A. from Houston, and we went on the Dinah Shore show. But I was in a wheelchair because I was in pain.
Oh, my God.
And I was wheeled on, but they stopped the tape when I was wheeled on to the show. And then they started the tape, you know, and we sang the San Francisco All.
So they didn't show the wheelchair.
They didn't show me in the wheelchair. But Dinah came over to us afterwards, and she put her hand on my shoulders, and she stopped the tape, and she talked with me intimately.
Yes.
And I told her what was happening. I said that I'm having a miscarriage, and she said, "Don't worry about it. I had 3 miscarriages. You'll be fine." And then they started the tape again.
Oh, my God.
I went back in the plane, and from the plane to, I was in a lot of pain, from the plane to the hospital in Houston. And Michael grew a lot of gray hairs overnight. And I had a DNC. And 2.5 weeks later, David was conceived.
Oh, my God.
And he was born in the Cedars-Sinai Hospital. And in the room, there was a painting. And it was a painting by Dinah Shore.
So tears in my eyes.
So wow. There you go. That's the story of...
Wow.
That's the story. That's the whole story.
Right.
Yeah.
And I, my memory of it is that I'm living in your apartment and you're on the road and you call me and you say, "I have to come home now because I'm pregnant," right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Right. They said that I needed to be in bed for at least 6 months.
Definitely. Right, right. I remember.
Yeah.
I remember it well. Wow, that's, so that is, it is a miracle, this story.
It is.
Right.
It is a miracle.
Yeah.
And I'm happy for Dr. Ingersoll, who said, you know, so anyhow. So you were with me during this miracle.
I was. I definitely was. I was. I remember. I was knitting something.
Yes. Were you crocheting?
Yeah, I was crocheting. I was crocheting.
You taught me how to crochet, actually.
Oh, did I?
Yes.
Then.
Yes.
That meant, right. Okay, so so then David is born. Mm-hmm. And how much longer did you guys live in L.A. after that?
Oh, good 6-7 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we had lots of nannies.
Yes, yes, because you were working.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so Michael did tell us the story, or his version of the story, which was that you felt that it wasn't safe for you to go out at night alone, and he said, "I can't live here anymore." Is that your version of it?
Well, actually, he would go into the bank and people would look at him.
Oh, really?
No, it just wasn't. Well, the real reason was that it just didn't seem right. We didn't really have friends with families.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Everyone was career-oriented. Mm-hmm. Me, L.A. And we had a whole family back here. And we had a child. And right after I conceived David, we got a call from Lake Tahoe where they wanted us to appear at one of the hotels because the general manager of the hotel in Houston also was a manager of a hotel in Lake Tahoe, and they wanted us to be in Lake Tahoe, and that was actually a big step for us, and we made the decision not to do that. And by making that decision, it really changed our whole lives, because we decided to have David.
Yes. Yeah.
So actually, David really did change our lives in a lot of ways. He made the not reaching the heights, so-called heights, really, you know, those heights are ridiculous heights compared to a family.
Yeah, yeah. You understood that there was a choice.
There was definitely a choice. If we had gone to Lake Tahoe, I probably would have had an abortion.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. So, my God, so really, this is the turning point in your life, mm-hmm. in terms of what your life is going to be about.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And it turns out that our life is now about children.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, what do you know?
What do you know? Right, right.
It only took a lifetime.
Well, it didn't actually take a lifetime.
Well, I'm not dead yet.
No, it didn't take a lifetime. But that's such an interesting conclusion, that you're confronted with the question. I just love this. I mean, we've said it, and I'm paraphrasing. So, but I really want to highlight it. You are confronted with the choice of pursuing the career you thought you wanted, where you thought you were going, mm-hmm. and you have a shot at it, mm-hmm. and then life says to you, yes, or
right.
this.
Right.
Right? And that's a significant, I mean, that's such a powerful thing to happen in somebody's life, that right. they get an opportunity to get the thing that they've been aiming at.
Yeah.
And life says, well, but what about this? You know? And then you say, yeah, right, that's better.
Yeah.
And not only do you choose that and do you get the family life, the child you always wanted, the life you always wanted in some ways, but it leads you inextricably to a different kind of career that's all about children.
That's right.
It's gorgeous. Yeah. It's so, I don't know, it's metaphysical in a way, don't you think?
I actually don't know what metaphysical means.
Well, good, you can believe me.
I know that it's beyond me.
Yes.
It's totally beyond
yes.
me. And that I get so much fun and pleasure out of being with children, you know. And I every time these little girls and boys audition in front of us, it's just unbelievable, the passion they have, the knowledge they have, you know. I always feel that my mother and my grandmother, they're with me and they're watching and
they're quelling.
Yeah. Just yeah.
So it's so clearly the right choice.
It was clearly the right choice. Yeah. Though, I mean, we did remain.
It doesn't mean that you're not playing, right? That's
but
right.
But not to the heights that we thought we would get, though who knows if we would have.
Yeah, but it seems to me that what happened was you got to have everything.
Yes. Eventually we got to have everything. Right. Well, actually we got to have everything once David was born.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Because you didn't have to give up performing. You didn't
no.
have to give up playing and singing. You didn't have to give up music.
Right. You right. know? But the music has taken on a lot more meaning in being able to pass it on.
Yes. It's so much less about you
yes.
and your achievement.
Yes.
And more about what you have to offer and
yes.
give.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It feels so much better.
Yes. 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 I think that's right. Wow. So do you want to say anything about Jazz as a Rainbow? Jazz as a Rainbow? No? You don't?
I can't imagine that Michael hasn't said everything about it.
Well, maybe. So if you say what he said, then it's repetitious, I'll take it out. But
all I know is that, you know, there are instances where you will, where we will introduce a song to somebody, and it might be a Billie Holiday song, and that person who's never heard Billie Holiday will burst out crying and saying, I have to sing that song. Let me sing that song. I can sing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then that person will just beam in front of like 400 people, and they'll get standing ovations and stuff because she's singing it from her heart. And, you know, it's like 2014, and it's still Billie Holiday singing over again.
Yes.
And it makes these children very proud of who they are, you know, and their heritage. And
because they're in a through line from that heritage.
That's right. They didn't know it because most of the time they were listening to rap.
Yes.
And when they hear melody, they just go crazy. They love it, you know. So
really?
Yeah, I know Michael told you that whenever we get a lunch break, sometimes our director will take them to the mall. Oh, And one year they were all learning a don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And they just all started, they just broke into a, what do they call it, a flash or something? But they didn't know they were doing it. It was like, you know, seven or eight kids, you know, like 9-year-old, and they all just started a don't mean a thing if it ain't got the swing. And everyone was looking at them in the mall, you know. They just loved that music.
And they loved to sing. And they loved to perform.
Yeah.
And they have an opportunity to do it now, which they would never have had.
Right. And it's not like we're coming to them and performing and workshopping. We're not doing that. We're giving them the reins, and they're having fun. And there doesn't seem to be any dissing in it. They're all encouraging each other. You know, if someone doesn't have a great voice, he'll give this great line, and if someone will play off of it. I mean, that's what theater is anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
But they have the safety. They feel a safety there.
Yes.
Which they don't necessarily feel
anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you had gone to Tahoe, none of these kids would have had this, right?
If we had gone to Tahoe, no.
Okay, so I ask one other question. And that is, having given a life to this work, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
Yeah, I can't believe how blessed.
It's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Lynn.
As often happens when I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and I ask them to tell me what that's been like, they are brought to tears. And that was the case with Lynn. And why is that? Well, I think it is because it's quite rare to have a life that is the life that was meant for you. That we discourage that more than we encourage that in our world. And so it often requires a struggle to achieve. And when it is achieved, there is a sense of tears of joy, tears of relief, tears that speak of the struggle that preceded it. So, as always, as I said in the run-up, when you listen to people like Lynn Jackson, I hope that you hear what it sounds like to be who you really are, to have done the struggle and achieved the result, to be living the life you actually were meant to live. And if you hear that and you are made aware that there are ways in which you are not doing that, maybe you have always thought of yourself as shy, have always wanted to be a person who stands up for himself or herself, tells it like it is, isn't worried about what other people are going to think about what you say or how you dress or how you talk or what you do for a living or who you marry or what you like to eat. I mean, I know people who really want to be vegetarians, but they're so afraid of the judgment of their families that they don't do it. So if you are someone who is aware of something that you have sacrificed in order to be what other people think you should be, and you want to recover yourself, to discover yourself, to be yourself, it is not too late. But again, as I said in the run-up, it is not as simple as, oh, yeah, right, oh, yes, I didn't want to be shy. Here, let me stand up and tell you what I think. Of course, you know, it is not that simple. Because when you go to recover the thing that you had to suppress, the reason that you suppressed it arrives at the same time in your mind. And there was always a good reason. We never suppress ourselves for no good reason. So that is the work of psychotherapy, of course. And if you're thinking about tackling, taking on, getting back, recovering something about yourself, think about exploring psychotherapy. If you want to talk to me about that, you can find me at my website, thelynshow.com. And we're going to go out on another song recorded by Lynn Jackson. I hope that you heard what I hear when I listen to both Lynn and Mike. These people sing from their soul. This is not just a performance. This is a being in action. You could hear it in Michael when he was singing You Are There at the beginning of the show. And this song, the famous Nina Simone song, she would be applauding to hear Lynn Jackson sing You Can Have Him. So we're going to go out on that. Here now, Lynn Jackson.
I don't want him. You can have him. He's not worth fighting for. Besides, there's plenty more where he came from. I don't want him, you can have him. I'm giving him the sack, and he can go right back where he came from. I'm afraid I never loved him. Sweetie, he'd be better off with you. I could never make him happy. All I ever wanted to do was rub my fingers through his curly locks, mend his underwear, don his socks, fetch his slippers, and remove his shoes, wipe his glasses when he's read the news, and rub his forehead with a gentle touch. Mornings after, when he's had a little too much, and kiss him gently when he cuddles near, and give him babies, one for every year. So you see, I don't want him, you can have him. You can have him. 'Cause I don't want him. Because he's not the man for me. Then I close the window as he soundly slept. I go to the icebox where the food was kept. I'd fix a breakfast that would please him the most. Some eggs and coffee, orange juice and butter toast. I don't want him, You can have him, you can have him. I don't want him, I don't want him. You can have him, because he's not the man for me.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. My face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle.